Prime time is anytime. Subscribe to the Primetime Sports Podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Grab a ladle. It's time to stir the pot. This is the Jeff Blair Show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
You know, don't think for a second that Canada's basketball feast is done just because the Raptors parade is over and we're sitting here waiting for Kawhi Leonard to make up a decision or to make up his mind. Tonight, once again, there is a chance that a Canadian-born basketball player will be selected earlier in the NBA draft than a Canadian-born hockey player goes in this weekend's NHL draft. You know, most mock drafts have RJ Barrett going third tonight to the New York Knicks, but there's a chance that at least four more, that's right, four more Canadian-born players could go before the end of the second round, including Montreal's Lugansz Dort, who will join our show in the 10 o'clock hour from Brooklyn, where the 6'4" guard could be an early second-round pick. And, you know, this is the real indication of the depth of Canadian basketball talent. You know, it's one thing to be good enough to be an RJ Barrett, to be a lottery pick, to be one of the transcendent few who are blessed with gifts that easily separate yourself from the pack. It's quite another to be able to carve out a niche from the pack in general, right? I mean, when you look at the population difference between Canada and the U.S. and the difference in the number of kids playing basketball in Canada and the U.S., when you take that into account, the fact that a Canadian kid can be drafted in the second round, where the process of sorting talent gets really complicated, the fact that a Canadian kid can go in the second round, that to me is the real measure of the depth of Canadian basketball talent. So we'll be joined by Lugansz Dort, and we'll continue our draft theme in the show as well when we're joined by Canadian country star Chad Brownlee, Juno nominee for 2017 for Country Album of the Year. He's just released a new single, Forever's Got to Start Somewhere, and he himself was a six-round draft pick of the Vancouver Canucks in 2003. So, today's theme, the draft. And Forever's Got to Start Somewhere, well, that kind of seems to be an oddly fitting theme song, doesn't it? For the NHL or NBA draft.
The Jeff Blair Show is on the air on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Join the conversation with Jeff on Twitter using the hashtag Blair Show or call 416-870-0590. Now, here's Jeff Blair.
When you talk about your right-handed, you know, I used to hear that you right-handed.
Yeah, I am.
So now everybody's saying you need to work on your right-handed, yeah. And I know you play left-handed, but talk to me, what are some of the things you want to do as far as working with your right hand?
It's funny, I actually prefer to dribble or pass with my right, but I like to score better with my left. So I don't really know, it's kind of weird, but I'm just trying to, you know, be able to come off and attack, go straight to the rim, my right, just everything.
So now you're changing up, you're going to be shooting with your right?
I used to when I was younger, but I stopped.
What hand do you write with?
I write with my right.
What hand do you pick up a fork with?
My right.
Throw a baseball?
Right.
But you shoot left.
Yeah.
That's an advantage.
Interesting.
I don't get it either.
That was RJ Barrett in conversation last night with Jared Greenberg and Steve Smith of NBA TV. And as we mentioned, RJ Barrett likely, well, in most mock drafts, tabbed to go third to the New York Knicks behind Zion Williamson and Jay Morant. And and RJ Barrett has made it pretty clear that he is more than happy. He is more than happy going to the Knicks. Michael Grange is our NBA insider on Sportsnet. Michael Grange joins us on the Jeff Blair Show. This is going to be an interesting draft, isn't it, Michael, for Canadians? Because as I said, we've had Canadians go first overall. We've had Canadians you know, go in the first round and all that. But when you start talking about guys being good enough that they can be, that a team will spend a second round draft pick on them, I mean, that really is a testament to the depth of Canadian talent in a draft, isn't it? Because at that point, you know, at that point, teams get picky, don't they?
Yeah, I think that's a fair way to put it, Jeff. I think the projections are that, there's going to be four Canadians taken in the first round, which would be a record. There could be as two lottery picks, which would tie the record, which has happened a couple of times in 13 and 14. And if one of the names that are, being projected as second round picks get taken, that would be a new record overall, because the most that's ever been taken in one round was four in 2014. So if four guys go in the first and whoever gets taken in the second, and there's as many as three names that are potential second round picks, you could have six or seven Canadians overall, which is, an enormous number. I mean, there's only 60 players taken. So to have conceivably 10 or 12%, if my math is right, taken from one country is kind of staggering when you think about it. And it's very interesting talking to, player agents and people who in the talent evaluation process, and, they take note. This is another stage in Canada's basketball growth where, the idea of being drafted by an NBA team is not foreign anymore. It's what a lot of the young guys expect. And this is kind of the fruition of that.
You know RJ pretty well. You know the family well. You've covered him an awful lot. RJ Barrett in New York, how would that work out, both from a basketball point of view and from a personality point of view?
I think it works out great. We maybe better than I, the New York media scene, and I think it gets oversold sometimes about how tough it is. I think New York's like any other market. If you really are committed to winning, and that's evident with how you carry yourself, prepare and compete, I think you have an easy time there. I mean, there's a lot of room for people in that market, for athletes in that market who just really want to bring it. And RJ brings it. He's not perfect. He's got holes in his game that he's got to work on. But in terms of his overall maturity, his ability to deal with off-court distractions, to deal with being in the spotlight, I mean, he's had that. And the Duke experience is really, really good for that. I think that people come out of that program really understanding what it means to be, a high-profile professional athlete. I think his relationship with Steve Nash, that of course goes back forever, I mean, I think he's had counsel on how to deal with being a public figure, how to find a way to manage and navigate those waters. And the on-court stuff should be easy, right? There's a couple of elements of his game he needs to develop. He needs to be a much more reliable shooter. That is work. He's fully prepared to do that. And I think he needs to be a little bit more engaged defender. And again, that's the ability is certainly there. And, if he's not playing 40 minutes a night as he was at Duke, I think he's got a little more energy on that end of the floor. But the rest of it is, I think, should unfold nicely. And I think it's also nice that he's going three, if that's where he ends up. Like, you go one, you go two, people want instant. At number three, I think there's a little bit more leeway given to allow you to develop and grow. So I think RJ Barrett with the Knicks is a good fit on the court, off the court, and it could be a great opportunity for him.
We heard an interview that he did with that we just played a bit of it with NBA TV. I didn't realize that he's a guy who, I mean, I knew that he shot left-handed. I didn't realize that it was, I just assumed he was a natural lefty. What aspects of his game, really, going to say really stand out, but what are the aspects of his game that maybe separate him from other players? And Michael, how odd is it to see a guy do that? To see a guy who shoots with, I'm going to call it his offhand. I don't know if he can, but to see a guy who is able to do that.
I mean, it happens, right? Tristan Thompson, I think, is in that category. Ben Simmons is in that category. I mean, unfortunately, as I think about it, it seems to be guys who are not necessarily great shooters.
Yeah, I know. I was just, I'm glad you said that. You know, I was just thinking that.
Yeah, you know, so maybe there's something goes on there. But, you know, I think the one thing that RJ really brings, and he's always had, is, you know, an awareness and a willingness to seek and absorb contact on the offensive end. He gets to the free throw line a lot, and it's not the most sexy skill, right? Like, I mean, you know, Zion Williamson's a lot more fun to watch in that respect. But, you know, one guy that RJ Barrett has always two guys RJ Barrett's always cited as sort of influences. One is LeBron, and why not? Of course you would. But the other is James Harden. And I think of the two, I see a little more James Harden potential for RJ, just in the sense that he's, you know, he's kind of a deceptive ball handler, a little bit herky-jerky. You know, he's not blowing by guys and rising over them all the time. But he gets that shoulder by, and, you know, and he's into your body all of a sudden. And, you know, you have no choice but to foul. And that's a great, you know, most guys, you know, took DeMar DeRozan 5-6 years into his career to learn that as a valuable skill. And it was almost the key that transformed him into an all-star once his free throw rate attempt went way, way up. And RJ's there already as a one and done true freshman out of Duke. So I think that awareness, that knowledge is good. And I think his team game is a lot better than people give him credit for. He is a willing passer. I watched him play a fair bit at Duke in person and, of course, on television. And he didn't have a lot of options. I mean, that was a poorly constructed team around Zion and RJ. They just did not have enough shooting. It's what did them in the end. But I saw RJ willing to make the smart pass. I thought he was a pretty accurate passer. He could pass with both hands. And I think if he's a primary ball handler, with the better spacing you get in the NBA and the better shooting you should have surrounding you in the NBA, I think his willingness and ability to playmaker will shine as well.
Now, in addition to RJ Barrett, you know, some of the other names to keep an eye on: Nickeil Alexander-Walker. I'm going to butcher this name. I'm going to try Fiondu Cabangeli, which I guess I did okay.
That's pretty good. That is good.
Dort, Brandon Clark, and then there's I didn't study this. Ignas Brazdeikis from Oakville, and Lindell Wigginton from Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, who is at Iowa State. Of this group, Michael, who's the guy that is the most, let's say, the most intriguing of them?
Well, all of them are in their own way. Cabangeli is, you know, he's a 6'10" guy with great shot blocking. Potential, good mobility, who shoots threes. And so he's a very projectable player, was a really good player coming off the bench as a sixth man for Florida State. I think he's going to be a good NBA player. Mm-hmm. Alexander Walker, now he's the first cousin of Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. They grew up together basically as brothers. And I think he's got, you know, great length, good shooter. I think he's got a chance to be a really interesting player as well. And then when you go with Dort, he's a kid out of Montreal. Montreal's sort of starting to really emerge as a basketball market. And I'm almost surprised he wasn't taken in the NFL draft. I'm not even joking. Like, he is the most dominant physical presence I think I've ever seen in Canadian basketball. He's about 6'2", 220, 6'3", maybe. Just absolutely explosive. He looks like an NFL running back or something like that. And, you know, he's a guy I think he projects really well as an NBA defender. Mm-hmm. I think he's gotten away with being so dominant physically as an offensive player, so he's got to add a lot more polish there. But I'm sure he'll get drafted because he has a chance to fill a role in the NBA. And Brazdeikis is, you know, he's an interesting pick to me too, because I think his IQ is there. I think his want to is there. I think he'll end up being a really good NBA shooter. And, you know, there's some questions about his foot speed and things like that, but he's just such a tough, aggressive, competitive kid. I think that's a big factor that allows guys to break through in the NBA. So, you know, I think all of them have opportunities to make some noise.
Do you expect to see, and I know the Raptors are drafting, what, they have the second last pick in the second round. Do you expect to see the Raptors involved at all in any activity today around the draft, or even after the draft? Or, again, I guess the obvious question, where are we waiting to see what Kawhi does before any other pieces start to move?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I could see them trying to move up in the second round. The cost for doing that is, I think it's been set at about $2 million to buy a second round pick. Because I think, you know, I'm not saying that they're going to do anything, but when you look at how the roster's constructed, if Kawhi Leonard comes back and Marc Gasol comes back, they're going to need cheap labor, right? They're going to need, you know, players that they can kind of plug in and develop. So, you know, the second round is usually an attractive way to find those, and you can get those players usually for, like I say, there's almost a dollar price on those picks. But in terms of making a major move to get into the first round or anything like that, I don't think so, in part because those salaries are guaranteed. And the Raptors, again, if they come back with a similar team as they had this year, they wouldn't want to have those salaries on the books, I don't think.
No, and it is interesting, too, when you look at, you know, one of the things that I think when you look back at this year's Raptors team, I mean, Masai Ujiri did tap into a lot of his bench depth in order to get this title. And, you know, if everybody comes back, as you say, you are good. You're almost in a situation where the Leafs are, where you need your 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, whatever. You need those guys. You need those guys to be relatively cheap. And relatively cheap generally means young, generally means free agents, or maybe a guy you take in the second round for a specific skill set that you lock off the bench.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. I mean, the second round picks aren't guaranteed. You know, you can typically get them at a league minimum. You can always add league minimum salaries. So I think that's sort of the thinking, and you know, the Raptors had a free agent camp midway through the finals, and I think that's an indicator of where they are. Mm-hmm. They need to find, you know, they need guys like Chris Boucher to be able to come out and play. They need, you know, they need the Malcolm Millers of the world to sort of make that next step and become rotation players. And if not, they need to find guys who can step into those roles or begin developing towards stepping into those roles. So they're in it's a tough spot for an NBA team to be, because, you know, they don't have a first round pick this year. The well, as you get better, the well gets drier. It's just the way it goes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where, you know, really the scouting staff matters, because you got to be able to find guys late in drafts, undrafted, and in the second round.
What commodity do they need the most right now off the bench? Again, let's just assume for argument's sake that Kawhi's back, Gasol's back, right, that everything stays the way it is. What commodity do you think they need off the bench?
I think they need point guard depth. You know, they were really lucky through the playoffs that neither Fred VanVleet or Kyle were injured to the extent they needed to miss. You know, they need to miss any time. So I think they could use a combo type guard who can play both positions and can shoot. And they probably need a little bit of depth at center, for the same argument where, you know, you were pretty thin after Gasol and Ibaka. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, is Eric Moreland that guy? I don't know, but I think those are a couple of needs that, they would need to, you know, I'm sure they'd like to address and shore up in a way. Cause I think they were a little bit vulnerable there and were lucky, you know, that, they didn't get bitten with the injury bug at all.
Any good Kawhi rumors for me? Any purchasing houses, going to school, getting credit cards from the Bay or whatever? Any good?
They're out there. I don't have any good ones other than the ones you've mentioned.
Yeah, okay.
I went with the one the other day where he was on, his Uncle Dennis was on social media and got interviewed by a little guy saying, you know, it wouldn't be a surprise if I told you if he was coming back. So I don't know. You know, I'm in the camp of, look, the Raptors have done a great job. I think it's interesting as East seems to be hollowing out a little bit.
Yeah.
Milwaukee potentially losing Middleton. Boston obviously kind of really taking a sideways step. And who knows what with Philly. You know, why would not Kawhi look at the East and say, I could be the new LeBron. Just book my finals appearance every year and go from there. I think there's a 51% chance he stays.
I don't know. Now, I understand Adrian Wojnarowski says it's a 56% chance he's going to the Clippers. I heard that. That was the news thing I heard. I heard it's now down to the Clippers and the Raptors. unless another team jumps in at the last minute. That's what I've been told.
I think your sources are good, Jeff.
Mr. Grange, take care.
And by the way, congrats again on that Hall of Fame recognition.
I appreciate it, man.
By the way, congrats on that. That's a great accomplishment and well deserved.
Thank you. It's a lot of fun. Take care.
All right, Jeff. Bye.
Michael Grange, NBA insider with Sportsnet. And again, the NBA draft goes tonight, 7 o'clock on Sportsnet 1. And as Michael said, there are five Canadians, seven Canadians. There could be as many as seven Canadians in the draft. There are a couple of candidates. Nickeil Alexander-Walker, they're considered to be candidates to potentially move up into lottery territory. RJ Barrett, as we said, is expected to go third overall to the New York Knicks. And of course, we could have one of those great NBA draft moments where a dude gets picked. And as soon as he's picked, everybody announces that everybody understands that he's been traded to another team, but he goes up and puts on his, whatever Minnesota Timberwolves hat and stands for the camera, even though everybody knows he's going to be moved. It could be a great day for Canadian basketball. Again, Lindell Wigginton, Ignas Brazdeikis, Fiondu Cabangeli, Lugans Dort, Brandon Clark, some of the names to keep an eye on. Of course, in addition to R.J. Barrett and Nickeil Alexander-Walker. Canada's men's basketball team, or Canada's men's soccer team. I'm sorry, I got basketball in my brain. Canada's men's soccer team faced a big test at the CONCACAF Gold Cup yesterday, last night, I should say, losing to Mexico. And an interesting match from a tactical point of view for Canada. The 3-1 loss, starting out with the 3-4-3 setup, eventually morphing into the 4-3-3 in the second half. That would be John Herdman's preferred formation. But it's really interesting watching a Canadian team against Mexico play tactical games with Mexico, knowing that they will likely face Mexico in the next stage of this competition. There was a real sense that John Herdman playing some mind games with the Mexicans. Starting lineup was interesting. Starting lineup he runs out there the next time they meet could be vastly different. We mentioned that he played the 4-3-3 in the second half, probably his preferred formation. 3-1 loss to Mexico in a match that was at the start all Mexico, Canada laying back, Canada attempting to hit in the counter a couple of times. Had a couple of chances. One was called back on the offside. But anytime Canada loses to Mexico, we typically take some joy in the fact that it was valiant, hard fought, et cetera, et cetera. I thought there were some real interesting tactical wrinkles we saw from Canada in this. And there is a difference between coaching tournament soccer and coaching a team in a league. There's a different tactical approach. There's a different mental approach. It's not simply a matter of thinking of the game in front of you. It really is a matter of thinking of the match ahead of you. John Molinaro is chief soccer reporter with Sportsnet. We'll talk to John Molinaro about the men's team and also our women's team. They're continuing the competition in the Women's World Cup. So we'll have a little footy talk when the Jeff Blair Show continues on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Yeah, it's a podcast, but we're still not going to let him swear. Subscribe to Tim and Sid at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Now more of the Jeff Blair Show on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Some baseball theme music for Molinaro, knowing his love. I want to thank John Molinaro, by the way, for making my introductory speech at St. Mary's, the Hall of Fame, on Saturday. It brought a tear to my eye. I mean, did have an invitation to come. Could have drank beer with Dwayne Ward and Pat Hentgen. Anyhow, the Canadian men's basketball team. Now, why am I thinking basketball? Derek, every time I think basketball, can you just send a jolt of electricity through me? Canadian men's soccer team. Losing 3-1 to Mexico last night at Mile High Stadium in the CONCACAF Gold Cup. Our women's team plays the biggest match of the Women's World Cup so far. For them, I would argue, today against the Netherlands, a much fancied Netherlands team, I might add. John Molinaro is senior soccer reporter at Sportsnet, chief soccer reporter at Sportsnet. And John Molinaro joins us on the Jeff Blair Show. Hello, Mr. Molinaro.
Hello, Blair. How are you?
I'm doing well. Want to come out to the ballpark with me tonight?
Oh, is there a game going on?
Never mind.
What are they, like 30 games below 500 now?
Stop it. So 3-1 loss to Mexico.
Yeah.
And, you know, before we took the break, I made the point, you know, people are going to roll their eyes, 3-1 loss to Mexico and, you know, gritty Canadians, valiant effort, yada, yada, et cetera, et cetera. Except I don't know. You know, it's funny. I was watching that and I didn't stay up for the whole game, but I dropped it about halfway through the second half. But I came away thinking, you know, and I know every time we come on, we think, you know, like we're tooting John Herdman's horn. But man, I came away thinking that there is a real strategic and tactical bent to this team that we haven't seen in the past. And I don't know how much of that is the coach or how much of that, John, quite frankly, is that there is more talent at his disposal. But I really like some of the things I've seen from this team. And the other thing I really like, and I know, you know, soccer fans know this very well. I mean, there you have to have a certain mindset to coach in a tournament versus coaching a league match, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you take a look at the Germans and at any major tournament, and the thing that they're always sort of complimented for is what I call tournament management. I think they understand more than anyone. You'll excuse the cliche that it's a marathon and not a sprint. Mm-hmm. And I think John gets that. So your question as to whether, you know, the tactical clarity, whether it's him or it's just the depth of and quality of players he has available to him, I think it's a little bit of both. You know, talking to Jonathan Osorio, you know, before the tournament, and I asked him about what John Herdman has brought to the club, to the team, and he said obviously he's helped change the culture and there's a togetherness amongst the players that he's never quite experienced, and this is his fourth Gold Cup. But he also said there's a clarity in everything that they do, from tactics to training to, you know, specific roles that players are given. So I think, you know, John he's really obviously helped to change the culture, but I think he's brought a clarity on all levels to the national team. And I think they're benefiting from that clarity right now.
Yeah. And it really does seem as if, you know, watching what he was doing last night, watching his selection, you really did get the sense that there was a certain aspect of trying out something to see how it looks against Mexico, maybe giving Mexico a bit of a false look in a couple of instances, but also keeping some stuff back. Like, I would think the next time they meet, he would, unless I'm wrong, would you think he'd start with a 4-3-3 right from the get-go next time? Or do you think we would see a 3-4-3 and then maybe it morph into a 4-3-3?
No, I think we'll see the 4-3-3, and it wasn't just the formation. It was, you know, who he held back yesterday. I mean, he made six lineup changes, and he didn't start Scott Arfield, Junior Hoylett, Jonathan David. Those were all the three guys who scored in the opener against Martinique. Osorio didn't start. So I think you're quite right. I think he was trying to show Mexico a different look, thinking that, you know, and I think John firmly believes that, you know, they're probably going to meet Mexico in the semifinals. That's, you know, for him to sort of look that far ahead and sort of, as I said, manage the tournament, you know, I think that's, you know, very progressive for him. I think there's an argument to be made that he's being a bit presumptuous and that, you know, they're probably going to have to get by Costa Rica in the next round before they get to the semifinals, and Costa Rica is no soft touch. But, you know, this is a different approach from a Canadian national team manager at a Gold Cup that I can't ever remember seeing. So it's a bit different. You know, if it works out in the end, then it works out in the end. We'll have to see how it plays out.
Atiba Hutchison playing in the back. What have you made of that decision so far? And is that something we will see for the rest of the tournament?
I think he's just filling sort of a role right now. I mean, they're not particularly deep at, you know, center back position. I think he's did okay. I mean, I would have faulted him a little bit for the opening goal yesterday. I think he could have been a little bit better. But I don't think it's his best position. I mean, I think he really has to be sort of be pushed further up into the central midfield. That's just his natural position. I think that's his best position. I suspect that as kind of guys get healthy a little bit, and we saw Daniil Henry play yesterday after missing the opener due to an injury, I suspect that, you know, John will push Atiba back into the midfield and just into a more natural role.
Now, let's shift focus a little bit to the women's team. They will play the Netherlands. This is the big match of the first round for them, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think this is sort of like the biggest match they've had in the Kenneth Heiner-Muller era since he took over for John Urban. They haven't really sort of faced an opponent like this. Well, maybe England. I think they played them in a friendly, but no question. After breezing through Cameroon and New Zealand, game at Canada really dominated and should have won. I think this is their stiffest test. The Netherlands are the reigning European champions, and the Dutch program has really kind of come on leaps and bounds in the last 5 to 10 years. So they're a very technical side. They're going to see more of the ball than Cameroon and New Zealand did. So I think this will be a stern test for Canada. I still think it's a winnable game for Canada. It's still a game that they should win because they've dominated the series historically. But I don't think there's any question that the Dutch are going to give them Canada their toughest game in France thus far.
What have you made of Canada so far at this tournament?
Getting the job done. Not spectacular. Was it 3 goals in 2 games? I mean, tight defensively. But again, I think you have to sort of look at the quality of the opposition. And I mean, you didn't really expect Cameroon or New Zealand to press them all that much. They've kind of done what they've had to do. They've been unspectacular, but they've got the job done. Christine Sinclair, I think people are unfairly criticizing her for not scoring any goals. But, she set a couple posts and she's had the goalkeepers come up with big saves to stop her. But, they've gotten by without her goals thus far. So, they've been solid. But again, I think this is going to be an entirely different test for them. So I'm really interested to see how they, if they can sort of up their game a bit when, the quality of the opposition is significantly tougher.
Yeah, it's interesting watching this team play and comparing it to some of the, the really good women's teams we've had in the past. There does seem to be a more, I don't know if I'd say a more pronounced emphasis on defense. There seems to be, I've often felt that Canadian teams sometimes panicked in the back defensively and got a little over anxious. And again, you're right, it depends on the quality of the opposition, John, but I don't get that sense from this team. They seem to be much more composed on the ball than Canadian teams in the past. I'm talking about at the back.
Yeah, I totally agree, Jeff. I mean, when you look at, a player like Kadisha Buchanan, who is, I think, 22, 23, and still, I think already regarded as one of the best center backs in international women's soccer, I think that says a lot. And the partnership she's formed with Shalina Zdorsky in the center of defense has been sensational. And that was sort of, Canada's problem last time out at the 2015 World Cup, was they didn't sort of have that defensive solidity, and it didn't seem like, a little bit frail at times. Now there's an assuredness and a solidity that wasn't always necessarily there. And I think, Buchanan is a big reason. I think Desiree Scott, too. I mean, you have to sort of give credit to the Canadian midfield and players like Desiree Scott, the Winnipeg-born midfielder, who really does a great job of protecting the back four and just sort of acting as that first line of defense. So I think it's the entire team. I mean, just from front to back, I think everyone sort of defends as one. So, obviously I think the back four deserve a lot of the credit, but I think just overall from a defensive structure, the team is just, more solid than it's ever been.
What have you made of the tournament, the quality of play, the organization of the tournament? There've been some really good matches. We all saw what happened in Thailand and the US, but there've been almost the obligatory ticket snafus when it comes to FIFA. I mean, you sort of accept that as it's going to happen. But the tournament itself, has the women's game taken a step forward in terms of quality, John?
I think it's just me maybe, but I think it's been more like a step sideways. Mm-hmm. I don't I don't think there's been sort of, I haven't been blown away compared to 2015. Like, I haven't said, oh, wow, the women's game has really kind of gone on leaps and bounds. As you said, you're still seeing, there's still a great disparity between the haves and have-nots. You know, the perfect example being, you know, the Americans thrashing Thailand. And, you know, Argentina is, you know, I think has come on. And then they did sensationally yesterday to come from 3-0 down to tie Scotland and knock them out of the competition. But I don't get the sense that I just don't see there being sort of massive improvement in the women's game. And I think that comes down to, you know, federations not sort of properly funding the women's game and just sort of not funneling proper resources into it. I think if you saw that, then, you know, these tournaments would be a little bit more competitive. I do think it's improved, I guess, a little bit in that, you know, now you're seeing sort of more players playing at top clubs in Europe and stuff like that. And, you know, Tanisha Buchanan is a perfect example. She plays in France with Olympique Lyon, and she's won Champions League titles. But overall, you know, I don't know that, you know, the quality of play or sort of the gap between, as I said, the haves and have-nots has shrunk since, 4 years ago in Canada.
Yeah, it does seem, it seems as if there's maybe a little more depth in Europe or a little more consistency with some of the European teams. But, you know, you mentioned the Argentine team, and, you know, the story about the Argentine team, they slept in their team bus before an international match because the federation didn't get a hotel room for them. They weren't allowed to practice on the men's grass pitch at the national training facility. They were essentially shoved off to the side and you know, practiced on a on an artificial pitch. And you still hear stories like, I mean, the Jamaican women's team, the only reason they're in this tournament is because the Marley family, Cedelia Marley, basically funded them. You still, unfortunately, hear those stories, don't you, of the organization, the national organizations, and how they treat women's soccer.
Yeah, and even Thailand is another one. I mean, the only reason that they're in the tournament is because they have this independent sort of backer who's sort of funding the team. And I think she's like a multimillionaire, and she's giving like the Thai players jobs as well, like non-soccer jobs when they're not training. So, again, I think it just sort of goes to, you know, the lack of FAs around the world not sort of properly funding their women's program. And, you know, I think FIFA bears some responsibility in this too. I mean, if they're really serious about this and promoting the women's game, then I think they would crack the whip a little bit and, you know, come down on these FAs and offer more prize money for the women's team as well. Mm-hmm. You know, there's, I don't think there's any question that the men's World Cup in terms of, you know, global appeal and money that it brings in is far surpasses the women's game. But I would suggest that the gap in sort of prize money is, you know, just ludicrously out of whack. So, I mean, if FIFA was really serious, I think they could do a lot more as well, in addition to the FAs doing more as well.
John, we're going to let you run. Appreciate you doing this. Again, the offer stands. You can come out watch some baseball tonight. Should be good fun. Jose Suarez pitching. Clayton Richard for the Blue Jays. Should be fun.
Go Angels.
You're a bad human being. Take care. That's John Molinaro, chief soccer reporter in Sportsnet. Again, the Canadian women play the Netherlands today. Canada, the biggest match of the tournament for them so far would guarantee, well, they're already going through, but this would guarantee them a first-place finish in their pool. The Canadian men, 3-1 losers last night to Mexico at Mile High Stadium in Denver. And I know we always say this, you Canadian soccer fans, we can say that I wouldn't say the score necessarily flattered the Mexicans, but it was a pretty decent performance by the Canadian team, and certainly offering a lot of hope for the next time the two sides meet. As we mentioned, we are at that stage in the NBA and the NHL offseason where we're talking about the draft. The NBA draft is tonight at 7:00 on Sportsnet 1. Lugans Dort, an NBA draft prospect, a Montrealer from Arizona State. You heard Michael Grange talk about him. He is scheduled to join us from Brooklyn at 10:15. He's there for the draft. And, of course, the NHL draft presented by Adidas goes this weekend. The first round starts at 7:30 p.m., or our coverage starts at 7:30 p.m. Friday on Sportsnet Ontario. Saturday, rounds 2 to 7 begin at 1 p.m. on Sportsnet Ontario. Sportsnet 1, the Leafs, of course, do not have a first-round draft pick as a result of the Jake Muzzin deal, but I fully expect to see the Leafs being active and possibly trading up for the same reason as Michael Grange pointed out. You may see the Raptors be active and trade up in the second round, because if you are a team that is good and is brushing up against a salary cap in either league, you need, I can't put this any other way, you need cheap labor. And both of those teams, both the Leafs and the Raptors, are right up against the cap, and they will be looking to, I think, to make moves in this draft. And in the case of the Leafs, I truly do expect to see the Leafs make a move to try to move up in the draft. I think the Leafs are going to be very aggressive. They may even have a surprise for us. We'll talk to Gord Stellick about that. But when we come back, I've been looking forward to this for a while. Chad Brownlee is a Canadian country music star, multi-Juno Award nominee. He has a new song out for Forever's Gotta Start Somewhere that is the number two most streamed Canadian country song of 2019. He's also a former Vancouver Canucks draft pick. And decided to forego a career in the NHL to write music. And he's had a lot of success doing that. It'll be interesting to get his take on this and just talk about how a guy goes from being a hockey player to a songwriter. Chad Brownlee joins us in studio. Lugan Stewart as well. It's the Jeff Blair Show on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Hockey Central at noon is Hockey Central at any time you want it to be. When you subscribe to the podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590, The Fan. On demand. Jeff Blair is the closest thing we have to a resident psychic, which is easy to say when psychics aren't real. This is the Jeff Blair Show. We see sports talk in your future now. On Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
8 a.m. on a downtown train, I would have walked up and asked your name. Midnight in a crowded room, I would have had to come talk to you. Anywhere, I don't care. Forever's gotta start somewhere. The dance floor of a dive bar, you would have walked by and stole my heart. Summer night at a county fair, I would have stopped my
All
tracks.
Right, welcome back to the Jeff Blair Show. Sportsnet 590. The fan, the song is Forever's Gotta Start Somewhere. It is the number two most streamed Canadian country song of 2019, number one at radio. It is by Chad Brownlee. He is a multi-Juno nominee, multi-award winner as well. And as we mentioned in the last hour, also a former draft pick of the Vancouver Canucks. We're very pleased to be joined in studio by Chad Brownlee. I'll ask the obvious question first. How does one go from being a draft pick of the Vancouver Canucks to being not just, you know, not just a country, not just a songwriter, but a country music star, songwriter, singer, and an actor as well, I'm told?
Yeah, it was quite the transition. I call it the easiest, hardest decision I ever had to make. Because most guys who had played the game for multiple years will say it takes a bit of time to kind of settle into your new skin after you've played something since you were 5, 6 years old. So at the end of the day, you know, I was 23 at the time when I stopped playing hockey, but at the end of the day, I felt life's too short to do anything besides what you love to do. And I really lost the love for the game, just full on lost the love for the game. I didn't want to go to the rink. I was counting down the seconds during a game. But I had my last and final shoulder injury while playing in the ECHL. And I had surgery on both of them before. So when I came back, I just couldn't play the same. I was just a stay-at-home, you know, steady defenseman on the penalty kill, nothing flashy. And when I lost that kind of mobility and that strength in my right arm, it changed the way that I played. And I guess I just didn't have enough love to battle through that and make a comeback. And because music was so strong in my life, I figured, well, I'm going to give this a shot while I'm still young.
Now, you're from Kelowna, correct?
Yeah, I grew up there.
And you grew up in Kelowna. You played hockey with Vernon in the BC JHL, went to Mankato State. What was it called? The name I remembered is Mankato State. That's how old I am, because I can remember that conference. I had friends who played hockey at Bemidji, but it wasn't called Mankato State when you were there, was it?
No, they got fancy and called it Minnesota State.
Minnesota State. Yeah. Very good. You were there on a full ride. You were drafted by the Canucks in the sixth round. What was that process like? And, you know, was it was it always in your mind that you were going to be a hockey player, you know, and that when that you were drafted, you were going to continue through? Or by that point, had you already started the process of, okay, I got to be at this point by this age, or I'm going to have to sit down and look at my options?
Yeah, to be honest, I knew that the NHL probably wasn't in the cards in that first year that I graduated from Minnesota State. But it was still something that I knew I could progress into.
Mm-hmm.
The AHL was something I would have put money on that I was going to be in the AHL for a few years,
right,
and work my way up to the NHL. I went to the Canucks camp after I graduated, ended up going to Binghamton with the Senators farm team. I just had a terrible camp there and then got sent down to the ECHL and just never kind of dug myself out of the psychological hole that I put myself in. So it was a bit of a journey for those 2 months after I graduated, but up until that point, yeah, there was still that thought of, you know, spending 10, 20 years playing professional hockey. So it really was a huge shakeup, for me when I realized that, oh my gosh, I don't want to do this anymore.
Did you write while you were playing? Like, were you writing songs all along when you were playing?
Yeah. I taught myself how to play guitar at 17 when I was, in Vernon with the Vipers, just, you know, to play some songs at parties, and I just enjoyed it. It was a release from the game. Then I wrote my first song in my dorm room freshman year at Minnesota State. And it was just
please tell me it was in the middle of a raging snowstorm or something like
that.
Most likely. All right, yes, good. Just because you've got to set the mood. Raging snowstorm in Minnesota, lonely Canadian guy with his guitar. It's perfect.
Exactly. Yeah, lots of fuel for songwriting. And it was a musical journal for me. I wrote a song for my parents, my sister, ex-girlfriends, current girlfriends, whatever I felt like writing at the time. Never thought I would make a career out of it. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a hobby really at the end of the day.
So how did you go from an enjoyable hobby, you know, the hockey career, as you said, ended at that point? Had you already made contact with people? Were you looking ahead to, or was it the type of thing that once hockey was over, you said, okay, now I got to focus on music?
Yeah, once hockey was over.
That was it.
And I knew nobody in the music industry.
Really?
Okay. Nobody. Yeah, it was my buddy's uncle, actually, who was a producer down in L.A. He had just moved back to B.C. He was the first one that I talked to because I said, I don't really know what direction to go here. I was spinning my wheels a little bit. I'd moved to Vancouver, was working as a server. Mm-hmm. Joey's doing open mics down in Kitsilano for, you know, eight people, and seven of them are the other musicians there that want to show you their song. So I talked to him. He got me in contact with a producer and an engineer, took out a big loan to do an EP. That EP ended up in the hands of my manager, who I was with for 8 years. And that's kind of the Cole's notes of it. I just took a huge financial hit to get a musical resume instead of just me singing on my laptop in these kind of crappy versions. And I trusted the vision and where I wanted to go, and it's amazing what happens when you have this conviction. And I had no plan B at this point.
Right.
And the universe is
basically music or bust.
It's music or bust. And, you know, the right people and the right opportunities just started to fall into place. And obviously there's obstacles along the way. But when you have that amount of confidence in what you're doing, those obstacles don't seem as big. And you just find a way to go through them.
I mean, hockey, you know, you talk to guys who play hockey at a high level, it's basically become 24/7, 365 days a year. How does the music industry compare to that, you know, in terms of touring, doing records, all the responsibilities that come with it? How would you compare the two? I was going to say the two grinds. I know that's kind of cliche-ish, but I think in a lot of ways, I would imagine playing the music is great, but there's got to be a grind part to playing the music as well. How do those two compare?
Yeah, I mean, with hockey, there's obviously a huge physical demand on you, and you need to work out and practice and play six, sometimes 7 days a week, where you don't have that in the music industry. But you'd go on a 5-6 week tour, sometimes 3 months, or, you know, huge bands go on 2-year world tours.
Mm-hmm.
It's tough, and some guys have families that they're away from for prolonged periods of time. It's really not super glamorous. You know, you're sleeping on a bus every night in a tiny little bunk, and, you know, you get a hotel room and you're pretty stoked about it. So the travel part is the grind, but once you get up on stage, man, it just kind of washes it all away, and it reminds you why you do it. And you got to put in time as a songwriter and work on your craft, just like any athlete. Doesn't matter what level you're at. I've been taking vocal lessons this past year to really get my voice to the next level. And I think that's come through on this new record that's about to drop. And I enjoy finding things about myself that I didn't know were inside me, something that I can bring out. And that's the hockey player in me, is just trying to get better all the time.
Do you, are you a note taker? Like, we had Max Kerman from the Arkells in here, and he was showing me his iPhone, which was smashed. But I mean, he's like taking notes all the time. He'll see something interesting and boom, it's there. And you never know if you're going to use it, but it's there. Are you like that? Are you a note taker? Is it more sort of, you are?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I've got, you know, song titles.
Yeah.
Just hundreds of song titles in my phone, or voice notes of melodies. You know, I'll be walking down the street with my dog, or, you know, in my truck, or whatever. And ideas just come out of nowhere. You can't plan them. You can plan a time to sit down to be creative, but the ideas themselves seem to have a mind of their own. So yeah, that's the nice thing of having these devices close to us, instead of carrying around a notepad and a pen, is that we can kind of jot down these ideas and bring them up at a later time.
When does the new album drop?
Tomorrow.
It's pretty good timing.
Very good.
You're excited about
it? I'm so excited. It's been over 3 years since my last record. Took a year off the road. Wasn't releasing music, which is a scary thing to do in the industry when you take your foot off the gas.
Why was that? I
felt a little bit of stagnation possibly sinking into my career. I had toured pretty hard for 5 years, you know, my own cross Canada tours. And I just didn't want to get to the point where I showed up in a town and someone says, wow, he was just here. So I got a new team as well, new management, new label. So I felt like this was the time to really, in a sense, reinvent myself and come back with some resurgence. And we definitely have. I couldn't be happier with the way that I've had this reentry into the industry.
So what are the plans for the summer?
Yeah, we got a few festival shows. I think only about six.
Like festivals?
I do. They're so much fun.
Yeah.
So much fun. I mean, everybody there is in a good mood, and they want you to be in a good mood. You're sharing this energy, and, you know, sometimes it's in front of 40,000 people, and that's something that I haven't experienced in any part of my life. You know, there were certain hockey games that I played in college where there's 16,000 people. That energy is just so contagious, and once you leave that stage, you have such a rush, such a high, and you want to do it again.
You did mention a little bit, and I won't ask you for details, but you're also involved in a movie.
Yeah.
Filmed in Calgary.
Yeah. I'm really excited about
that. How did that come about?
Actually they sent a message to my manager, and, I'm a firm believer in manifestation, and when you send certain things out to the universe, they send you gifts, when you least expect it. And this was one of them, because I had done acting pretty much my whole life through school and in high school. I took acting and improv and whatnot, and I was in a Grease musical in middle school, and so I really enjoy that side of it. And for the last, I'd say, year or two, I was really serious about kind of getting into the acting world, and this opportunity just fell on our lap, and I couldn't be happier. I'm looking forward to diving into it.
You still live in Kelowna, right? Is that where you spend most of your time?
No, I'm in Gibson's.
You're in Gibson's, okay.
Yeah.
Home of Ryan Dempster.
You got it, yeah. His jersey's up on the gym wall.
Absolutely.
That I go to, yeah.
Are you, as a songwriter, do you find that you need to sort of, you know, you talk to some people, they'll say they kind of like just going away from people, and when they actually sit down to compose the song, whether it's on the piano or guitar, they kind of need their space where they're on their own. Are you like that, or can you kind of work in a busier environment, you know, with people around you, or will you go to a cabin and write and play and then sort of come down from the mountains and record it? How do you go about doing
that? I'm a very solitary person.
Yeah.
I'm a good loner.
Yeah.
I've just got a one bedroom cottage, me and my dog, in Gibson's there. So I like the peace. It allows me to have an environment where I feel like creativity flows a lot more. And then I'll take these ideas. I go down to Nashville a lot to write with, some friends that I've gotten to know over the years, and bring them the ideas, and then we make it a song. So everybody is so different. Some people like to be in the middle of a busy city, or you know, go sit in a cafe and get ideas to have that stimulation, to give them ideas. But for me, ever since I was a kid, I mean, my parents took me camping. They'd have to pull me off the shore from fishing for hours and hours and hours. I could sit and draw for hours. So that hasn't changed, and that's just how I approach my creative process.
You talked about I'm always fascinated in how people write songs with other people, because a lot of your songs are really personal. How do you go about, I guess you have to know the people, right? If you've got a song that's personal and other people are helping you write, you got to really trust those people because you're giving them a bit of yourself to sort of help you develop. How do you go about finding those people, the other writers? Is it social or your managers set it up?
Yeah, I was fortunate when I first got into the industry. My manager already had a bit of a Rolodex. He had worked with an artist previous to me. So he brought in his contacts, and that was kind of the foundation of the creative repertoire of people that I had down there. And then it just grows from there, and you find writers that you like, and then the next time you go down, you hook up a session, and then maybe they'll bring somebody else in and give them a little idea of what my music's like, and then they become your friend, and so you're the group of people that you get to know just grows and grows and grows. So it's been about a decade that I've gone back and forth between here in Nashville. And the co-writing process, I absolutely love. I was writing by myself.
Really? Even as a loner, you like the co-writing?
I do, absolutely, because I can get a little too inside my own head. So it's nice to have somebody to bounce ideas off of. Or if you get stuck, then they say something that just opens up a whole nother Pandora's box of ideas.
Right.
So I really do enjoy the co-writing process. But to get ideas, I like to be by myself, to get things started, kind of like a song seed, I like to call it.
You talked about playing some festivals this summer. It seems to me that the way the music industry is now, you talk to people a lot of times, they'll tell you that when you cut a record, it's almost like you're laying down a soundtrack for a show for the next concert. It's just the way things are now in the industry. Are you cognizant of that when you write an album? Like, how is this going to sound if I am standing on a stage in front of whatever 20,000 people, or I'm at a festival? How is this song going to sound if it's followed by this song and then followed by this song?
Well, that's exactly it.
That's a complicated process, man. That's like...
Yeah, you kind of have to have a glimpse into the future and envision what it would feel like to be on stage, because the live show is a huge part of my career.
Right.
So you need to be conscious of that. And every time I'm in the middle of writing it, I ask that exact thing. Like, can I picture myself singing this on a big festival stage? And is this something that people will enjoy?
The song is Forever's Gotta Start Somewhere. The album drops today. The album title is
Back in the Game.
Back in the Game. Fitting title. Chad, thanks so much for joining us. It's great to talk to you. Best of luck with the album, and have fun this summer, man.
Thanks a lot, Jeff. Appreciate
it. Very much. Take care. Chad Brownlee joining us on The Jeff Blair Show. Again, the song is Forever's Gotta Start Somewhere. And you can go to some website. Just looking at the website right now. And you can get details on concert appearances and the album itself. Thanks again, Chad. Appreciate it. We mentioned that the NBA draft goes tonight in Brooklyn. We talked a little bit about the number of Canadians that are expected to be chosen in the draft this year. There could be as many as seven. We know that R.J. Barrett is expected to go. R.J. Barrett is expected to go third overall to the New York Knicks. And there could be as many as six other Canadians we mentioned who go as well. One of those Canadians who has received a lot of acclaim and is expected to be drafted is a Montrealer out of Arizona State. Lugans Dort joins us from Brooklyn. Lugans, thanks so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it. Man, this has got to seem this has got to seem like a whirlwind for you.
A little bit, yeah. Just me being in this position right now from Montreal, Canada, it means a lot.
When did you sort of get the idea or get the feeling that you were on a lot of people's radar as, you know, a potential? I mean, some people are saying late first round. Who knows the way the draft goes? Teams are going to be trading up. Teams are going to be moving down. But Lugans, when did you kind of get the idea that, okay, this is to the point now where, I could be doing something real good here. I could be a pretty high draft pick. When did that settle in? Was it the start of the year? Was there a game perhaps or something that really signaled that to you?
It was really the start of the year. My first five games probably, I started playing really good, and then that's when people started knowing who I was. And then it's really when I see my name starting to be on the mug draft and stuff. And this is when I start working harder, and this gave me more motivation.
What's this process? What's been the coolest part of this process for you so far?
Just me being able to go visit a lot of cities and work out for a lot of teams. I mean, I worked out for 12 teams, and it was just fun meeting all the staff, and I seen some players too, and getting to go see all the cities. It was nice too.
You know, when you talk to players about going to work out for NBA teams, there's always kind of a fine line between doing too much and overexposing yourself and essentially getting tired and just kind of doing enough to show people what you need to show. How aware were you of that? And was it a grind when you're going, you know, you're going to different workouts and you're being asked to do different things and maybe some similar things? And how much of a grind was that?
It was definitely a grind. It's something that I prepared for at the beginning when I first declared for the draft. So I knew it was coming. So I was in the gym a lot, just getting my body ready for that. And then even when I was doing the workout, I was using the cold tub and stuff. I was just taking care of my body.
How would you describe yourself as a player?
I'm a top player. I bring a lot of intensity. I'm a pretty good on-ball defender. I bring a lot on offense too, getting to the rim, getting my teammates involved. And I'm really high intensity player.
Tell me a little bit about how you came to play basketball in Canada. I know that you were playing soccer, I believe, until you were 12 or 13.
Yes.
I look at you on TV and I go, man, how come this dude didn't play football as well? When I look at you on TV, how did it come about that you got really into basketball?
It was really when I was young, I started playing soccer, and then my best friends were all playing basketball, and I was hanging out with them every day and stuff. So I just started playing basketball with them, and then this is really how I started falling in love with the sport, and I just kept playing basketball with them every day. And I just told my mom one day I want to keep playing basketball, I want to start playing soccer, and this is how I stick with basketball.
And Lugans, the process of getting to Arizona, how did that come about? Were there other schools involved, and how did you end up making that decision ultimately?
Yeah, I had a lot of offers. I had a lot of school, and then it really came out with the assistant coach Anthony Coleman that really recruited me for a long time, and then I seen what Coach Shirley and the whole staff over there was building, and then I just fell in love with the place and how they were treating me. And then I just liked the way that Arizona was playing the period past year. And then I knew that they had some guards leaving the year that I got there. So I already had a spot. So it was just fun. And I have no regret for this choice.
Who's your, who are the guys, the players you looked up to? I mean, I've read that Russell Westbrook and Derrick Rose are two guys that I don't know if I'd say you pattern your game after, but those are two guys that you look up to and two guys whose career you followed.
Yeah, I mean, always since I started playing basketball, these were the guys that I started watching. And then I just like the way how hard they play and how tough they play. I just felt like I could be, sometimes my game is similar to them just because how strong they are and how fast they are.
Lugans, listen, we appreciate you joining us. Congratulations on a great college career. We'll be watching for you tonight. We'll have our fingers crossed for you. Stay healthy, and thanks so much for doing this, man, and enjoy the process. You've earned it, and you deserve it.
Thank you.
Lugan Stewart, Montrealer, who's expected to go late first round, second round, during the NBA draft tonight out of Arizona State University. And again, the NBA draft, 7 p.m. tonight on Sportsnet 1. The NHL draft will go Friday and Saturday on Sportsnet. And as we mentioned, the Toronto Maple Leafs do not have a first-round pick because of the Jake Muzzin deal, but wouldn't surprise anybody, I don't think, to see the Leafs maybe try to move up in the second round. The Leafs need cheap labor. I cannot put it any other way. If Mitch Marner's contract gets done, they're going to have to find a bunch of guys who produce, making not a great deal of money. And in order to do that, you may have to move some of your own players. And in order to replenish the farm system, you may have to move up in the draft to do it. Gord Stellick is co-host of Leafs Nation pre- and post-game on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. And Gord Stellick will join us when the Jeff Blair Show continues on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Good show, good podcast. Subscribe to podcasts of Good Show at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Now more of the Jeff Blair Show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Kevin Barker joins me in a few minutes for Baseball Central. My God, that was a hard game to watch last night. Jays and Angels, 11-6 win for the Angels. We got a lot to talk about with Barker, man. Look, you know, if you listen to this show, you know that we're big Aaron Sanchez fans. I thought he looked lost last night. His body language. There's got to be a lot of concern there. But we've got a lot to talk about. And Mike Trout's pretty damn special. I think that goes without saying. The Jays and Angels will wrap up their series tonight. 7 o'clock is the first pitch on Sportsnet 590. The Fan of Sportsnet Ontario. Jose Suarez on the mound for the Angels. Clayton Richard for the Blue Jays. Blue Jays Central will get you set for the game at 6:30 p.m. As I mentioned, first pitch after 7. And then the Blue Jays talk with Scott MacArthur right after the final out on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Big night tonight. NBA draft. 10 Canadians could be going in that. Friday, the first round of the NHL draft. 7:30 p.m. on Sportsnet Ontario. Saturday, rounds 2 to 7 are at 1 p.m. on Sportsnet Ontario. Toronto Maple Leafs, as we mentioned, do not have a first-round pick as a result of the Jake Muzzin deal. Could we expect to see the Leafs do anything in and around the draft? We know the focus is all on getting Mitch Marner signed, as it should be. But could the Leafs, who are going to need a fair amount of cheap talent over the course of these next three seasons, could the Leafs be prepared to maybe move up in the draft? Gord Stellick is co-host of Leafs Nation pre- and post-game on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. And Mr. Stellick joins us on the Jeff Blair Show. Good morning, Gordon.
Did you ever think it would come to a Canadian will go higher in the NBA draft than the NHL draft?
It's happened before, hasn't it?
I guess so.
Anthony Bennett went first overall. I think it's happened before.
But okay, never happened when a Canadian's expected to go first overall in an NBA draft.
Yeah.
That one was a bit of a shocker. But, yeah, no, you're right. It just kind of shows the way things go. Yeah, you talked about the Toronto Maple Leafs, and, I don't know about moving up. I think that's going to be hard to do. I think there's a little bit, as you alluded to, they got a lot of kind of holes to fill cap-wise with the Marlowe situation and the Zaitsev situation about trying to find destinations there that work. And then the Marner situation, you know, just about getting their RFAs, and there's a number of them in line. So Kyle Dubas has a lot of busy work to do, but you never know. This is the time. This is the time for trades.
Well, and you know, and I was thinking, you know, it seems to me that if you're the Leafs and you are looking at Patrick Marlowe, you're looking at Nikita Zaitsev. I mean, it's almost as if it's not that you don't want good players. Clearly you want good players, but it seems to me that where the Leafs are right now, Gord, there's more value to a second round pick than, you know, some guy who's going to come in and be another Connor Brown.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you're still going to need those. You're still going to need someone to come in and play.
True.
But you can't just take a cap hit on someone who's, you're right, who's going to be a fourth liner or a seventh defenseman or something like that. So you have your challenges with the Leafs depth wise on D. That's not going to change this weekend. But it is interesting. I mean, everyone likes the big trade. And a few years ago when you had Subban and Shea Weber, those kinds of trades going bang, bang, bang. I mean, the other thing, it's more massaging that you can improve little pieces along the way. And if you don't have Marleau, if you don't have Zaitsev, and if you don't have Jake Gardner, although you got to replace them, I mean, that's a lot of cap space that you freed up from a team that desperately needs cap space.
What do you think organizationally would be an area of focus for the Leafs? Like, understandably, look, they still have the same defense issues that they had at the start of last year. But in terms of the, you know, looking down at the Marlies, looking at where the Leafs are right now, do they need at some point to sort of, I don't know if I'd say identify a goaltender of the future, but do they need to bring somebody in, or do they have somebody in already who, you know, if Garrett Sparks is traded or is moved one way or another, you know, somebody that they might be able to develop into a competent backup? Because I think we saw this year that that's something that the Leafs are going to have to focus on with Freddie Anderson.
I think it's always a good idea about having that. And then, you know, best case scenario, you see a guy like Andrei Vasilevskiy winning the Vezina Trophy last night. And of course, you know, he was the prospect. He was a first round pick, but they had Ben Bishop. So Tampa Bay Lightning could then move on the higher paid Ben Bishop and keep, you know, the lesser paid Andrei Vasilevskiy, and he merged. He became the number one goaltender. I'm not saying you're expecting somebody to supplant Freddie Anderson right now in Toronto, but yeah, you should always have one in the offing. And when a goaltender gets hurt, you really need a competent one to, whether if it's a Curtis McElhinney type veteran or a young guy, you need that upgraded because you can't have any deficiencies in goal. So I agree with you in that sense. The other sense, Jeff, and where I'm not concerned is I give them great marks about how they've been developing players along the way. There really isn't a dog contract on the Toronto Maple Leafs right now, say like they've had in the past, and you know, say like Bobby Ryan's would be in Ottawa right now, for example. And, you know, as much as these guys say the Cali Rosens of the world are unproven at the NHL level, at least they've developed well in the American Hockey League. Like, you're not taking full-fledged flyers on these guys. You saw with Andreas Janssen coming up. I mean, these were elite American Hockey League players. So you're hoping, based on merit, they can jump in and help with the depth that way.
You know, it's interesting. Our friend, and you know, now that we're, as I said, we're on the eve of the draft, and there's sort of people are taking a look at larger league-wide issues. In a lot of ways, we've just seen a team win the Stanley Cup that was dead last, and I accent on or emphasis on the word dead at one point in the NHL season. They came on to win the Stanley Cup with a goaltender that certainly at the start of the year wasn't much fancied by anybody. But our friend Michael Tracos had a sit down with Austin Matthews in Vegas, and one of the questions Michael asked him was about whether or not he thought we'd see load management in the NHL now that, you know, clearly what the Raptors did with Kawhi Leonard paid some dividends. And Austin Matthews' answer, kind of surprisingly, was, yeah, you know, the way sports science is now, I'm sure this is a thing that's coming down the pike. And, my first thought, Gord, was, oh, Austin Matthews, another ice time issue we're going to have to deal with. Now it's Austin Matthews and load management. My brain's going to explode. But I'm just wondering if there are... This was kind of an odd year for sports because we saw St. Louis do that. We saw them go from last place to win the Stanley Cup. We saw the Toronto Raptors win, basically nursing their star player through the regular season to unleash him in the playoffs. Like, there was a lot going on in sports right now. Can you see the NHL kind of copycatting some of those things?
You know, it becomes a sexy word because how it played out with the Toronto Raptors. But you had, in Kawhi Leonard's case, what, he played 9 games or so the previous year. The guy had basically missed an entire season. And I'm all for the sports science element about it, but it's funny. You rest somebody and then you get knocked out in the first round and you go, what the hell we rest them for? In a lot of ways, you know, we could have done better in the regular season versus if you go through the grind of making it to the final in either the NBA or the NHL, it's a bit different story. Then you get into the thing about the 82 regular season games. And at what point is it acceptable load management or whatever term you want to use? And the other thing, you start diminishing the value to the fans of those 82 regular season games. It doesn't mean, you know, players should be playing when they're exhausted and risking injury in that, but, you know, they've done that for a number of years. So it'll be interesting how it gets applied. And it's funny, Austin Matthews saying that, you think more about a veteran player, not a young player. And certainly in his case, when you're hurt, I don't think there's any load management. I think everybody agrees that you're hurt and you don't play. Maybe he's talking about coming back from an injury, and because you're coming back, you don't play, you know, like he has, you don't play 100% of the games. And maybe by having that word load management, it takes away the pressure that maybe that the player feels to play. We saw that with Kevin Durant as much, that you don't want the player to feel some kind of pressure to get back in. So it is an interesting term. It's an interesting concept. And I could see teams being more open to applying it to some way, shape, or form. But if you're doing it en masse, and whatever team comes to town has two of their star players out, we saw with Vlade Guerrero, right, on Victoria Day Monday. Like, you know, you gotta be a little bit careful with that as well.
Who are you keeping an eye on as we go into the draft, the first round on Friday? Is there a team that is of particular interest to you, Gordy, a team that could be really aggressive? And is there a player we could see moved as a result of that around this draft?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is the time now. This has supplanted the NHL actual trade deadline. This is the better trade deadline
as everyone
tries
to
figure out what they can do. And, I mean, it's interesting. P.K. Subban was one of those guys a couple of years ago front and center, and he's obviously out there because, again, cap reasons for the Nashville Predators as far as making a move like that. So, I mean, that would be, you know, one guy I look, and it's funny. These trades, as we found a few years ago, nobody got a super inkling about them all coming about. It'll be interesting where, yeah, I think Corey Perry can be an asset where he chooses to go. I'm not talking being a Hart Trophy winner again, but that brings another player up there. Wayne Simmonds wins the Mark Messier Leadership Award, even though he had a disappointing finish to his season last year. That's another guy that's out there. But the trades, it's funny. You kind of sit back and wait and see what happens that way. But Jim Rutherford would be one because he's up front. He tried to trade Phil Kessel, and Kessel wouldn't agree to it. But Jim Rutherford hasn't sit still either. So that's a team I look at, and Nashville probably another team that I look at.
The it was funny as you were talking. I was just thinking about I was going back and kind of thinking again about how the Blues did what they did, this year, and you know, and just all the things that had to fall in place. You were a general manager in this league. You were a hockey executive. How has that job changed, Gord? You know, it seems to me even in the course of the last 3 years, there's just the general manager's job is different at this time of the year. There's more voices. I don't know if there's more pressure. There certainly seems to be more info. How do these guys go about sort of filtering everything out?
You know, and as you know, being on the media side years ago, you had to get a hold of people. That was cumbersome. Like if a GM was out traveling, you couldn't get a hold of the guy by cell phone or things like that. And so that process isn't there as much about, although you do have to spend time talking to the other 30 general managers, just general calls and just sort of the state of the nation calls for all the other teams. But you're right about the incredible amount of information now, the resources that are out there, big money involved. So they're bigger mistakes that can be made rather than little mistakes. But I think at the end of the day, it comes down to surrounding yourself with good people. And now you have the resources to surround yourself with more people. And at the end of the day, you've got to be unafraid to make the best decisions. The buck has to stop with you. And you've got to make those decisions that you genuinely feel are in the best interests of your hockey team. So I think that part's the same, but you're right about the other element. It's not as intimate as it used to be, and there's just everything coming at you, you know, Corsi stats and you name it, where before you were excited to get games on the satellite dish to be able to watch out-of-town games and what have you.
Where do you think the Mitch Marner situation is going? Are we going to get a deal here, and is this thing going to drag on and on? And can the Leafs, let's be honest, Gord, can the Leafs afford to let this drag on? I don't think they can.
No, they can't. And so Mitch Marner will get more than he would have got, obviously, last July when the belief is, and I go by Nick Kypreos, the number 9 would have done it. So, again, you can't cry over spilt milk. So from a management point of view, it'll be more money than you probably anticipated you would be forking out to him, but it's certainly not a dog contract because he's an elite player. So the challenge is you'll have a little less money for anybody else. But I'm one of those people that don't think the offer sheets are going to come the way of Mitch Marner. We'll see, but I really don't. And because obviously the Leafs will match it. So I think even though 11 is that number that they really didn't want to pay. And I know, you know, Kipper can say on behalf of his camp that now that Skinner got it, they think it's even more. But, you know, that's about the number. Kyle Dubas put down July 1st as a deadline, which at his post-season press conference, which I didn't know really understand why he would want to put that pressure on him to get a, you know, a deadline like that, which really doesn't exist. It only exists because offers can be entertained, but ultimately you control the fate of the player. So, yeah, it'll get done. But it's, boy, it shows why you don't want distractions in Toronto when it comes to hockey. Try to get things done and not ride a whole season with all these contractual distractions if you can avoid it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what happened with William Nylander last year, and it's really kind of odd how these things sort of piggyback on top of each other, but what happened with William Nylander, I think, sort of undid a lot of the good that happened with Austin Matthews. You know, if William Nylander had been settled, we'd be talking about Marner and the Leafs, and we'd say, well, they got Matthews and Nylander done, so, I mean, this is going to get done. We'll ride it out. But because of what we saw with William Nylander, you know, I think people are probably a little worried. Like, the thing I can't wrap my head around, Gordy, I can't wrap my head around this not getting done and Mitch Marner being in the city. Like, William Nylander at least was way the hell over in Sweden. I can't wrap my head around this not getting done and Marner being in the city. I still think that counts for something.
Yeah, you and me both. And Kyle Dubas was, you know, in fairness to him, he sort of came in as a supply teacher with contracts. I mean,
he was
guiding the Marlies to a Stanley Cup, a great job in securing John Tavares as a free agent, being part of that group. But man, you know it. It's a day by day process. Like, you know, Austin Matthews, you know, talking about his sister and parents love Lou, and I'm not waxing poetic about Lou that way, but it's a day by day process. So all of a sudden you got handed the keys to the car and you had these big contracts to get done, and you know, it's complicated. And he says, yeah, I sat back and I probably should have pounced that first week. I know Austin Matthews was right to be getting done July 2nd, 3rd, or 4th. And, you know, I believe Marner the same. But anyway, I say that in all fairness to Kyle Dubas, that was an opportunity missed. So it's going to cost them a little bit more. But the point is, they're very talented guys, and that's the main thing.
Gordy, we're going to let you scoot. Appreciate you doing this. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Jeff.
Gord Stellick, co-host of our Leafs Nation pre- and post-game on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. So, a rundown, because it is NBA draft day, and that is followed by NHL draft weekend. The NBA draft, 7 p.m. tonight on Sportsnet 1. As we mentioned, R.J. Barrett expected to go third overall to the New York Knicks. Could be as many as 7 Canadians chosen. And the NHL draft, Friday, the first round. Coverage begins at 7:30 p.m. on Sportsnet Ontario. Saturday, rounds 2 to 7 will begin at 1 p.m. on Sportsnet Ontario. Do we have radio coverage of the draft? And we have radio coverage of the draft on Saturday from Vancouver. So again, of course, because we have the Jays game Friday, pardon me, Saturday, rounds 2 to 7 begin at 1 o'clock on Sportsnet Ontario. The NBA draft, as I mentioned, tonight at 7 p.m. on Sportsnet 1. There will be Blue Jays baseball tonight on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet 1, the NHL Awards, as well as 8 o'clock on Sportsnet. The Angels and the Blue Jays wrapping up a four-game series at the Rogers Centre. The Blue Jays falling 11-6 to the Los Angeles Angels last night. Mike Trout putting on a show, if you were lucky enough to be there. Mike Trout putting on a show for the Angels. Another shaky outing from Aaron Sanchez, a string of shaky outings from Aaron Sanchez. You know, Ben Nicholson Smith and myself were on Blue Jay Central last night talking about all the trade rumors surrounding Marcus Stroman and Aaron Sanchez. I've got to tell you the truth. I have not heard a trade rumor surrounding Aaron Sanchez. Aaron Sanchez was asked about this. I have not heard a trade rumor surrounding Aaron Sanchez. I've spoken to a couple of people. Like, everybody knows what Aaron Sanchez is capable of doing. Everybody knows what Aaron Sanchez was a couple of years ago. But, folks, you're not getting anything for him right now. So I think we need to stop talking about Aaron Sanchez trade rumors. There are trade rumors in general around the team. Aaron Sanchez right now, the Jays need Aaron Sanchez to get right. They need him to get right for themselves. More than anything else, they need him to get right for themselves. You're not going to get maximum value for him right now. So we need to put aside that idea. Want to talk about Marcus Stroman being traded? That's fine. We need to put aside the idea, at least now, of Aaron Sanchez being traded. Right now, the idea is to try to get Aaron Sanchez straightened out. Does Kevin Barker have any answers for that? I see him holding a bunch of papers, chatting excitedly with Travis McKenzie. That would indicate to me that Kevin Barker knows exactly what's wrong with Aaron Sanchez. So we'll bring Kevin Barker in. Time now for Baseball Central on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.